Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of August 26th, 2011. You have very little control over the turbulent national economy, so why not just concentrate on the control you have over your own economy? But how far do you go?
When you talk about things that are more behavioral, like going out to eat less or trying to make smaller discretionary purchases, those are things where you're constantly having to remake a decision and always struggling against yourself.
We'll look at the pros and cons of domestic downsizing. 10 years ago, the economy was booming, but America's low-wage workers struggled to get by. Has anything changed?
The line became, you're lucky to have any job, so just shut up and do it.
Nickeled and dimed a decade on. And speaking of dimes,
we sell lemonade, iced tea, Arnold Palmer's, and popsicles.
Okay, those will actually set you back a dollar. And there's a recession lesson in there somewhere, too. Those stories and more coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
So let me get this straight. First, we had the debt ceiling crisis, then the S&P downgrade, followed by stock market mayhem, and now earthquakes and hurricanes all in one week. Feeling like things are a tad out of your control? Well, as we like to preach in this hour, take control of the things you can control. For lots of Americans over the last months, if not years, that has meant a serious financial downsizing. Not always easy, but doable. So for inspiration, let's hear from some folks who've done it.
This is John Mark Wendler from San Diego, and I'm an accountant.
I'm John Mark's wife, Lauren, and I'm a nurse.
Lauren and I have been married for 3 years, and we had student debt, and we're going out to dinner almost every weekend and pretty much spending frivolously. But we really had that moment there where it was like we have this certain amount of money that is going to get us through. So we decided to just take a few steps, like cut cable and go out to eat a lot less and those type of things in order to get by.
Some of the things that we've done to downsize our lifestyle, I've gotten into cutting coupons and following a lot of blogs that have tips on how to save money. And I think I've redesigned the way I think of making meals, and that's definitely saved a lot of money for us. And then also we went from a two-bedroom to a studio loft. That also helped us get rid of a lot of extra stuff that we had.
I don't know, we're kind of get excited about spending less money on things. You don't really realize that a lot of those things that you had been doing before, you can live perfectly fine without. And especially with the space, going from a two-bedroom, two-bath to this studio loft closer to where I work, now I can, you know, walk home for lunch. And so that's, you know, saving money too, where I know I work with people who go out to eat every single day. So that's where I would say quality of life is increased, just by having less stuff and having less things to worry about.
John Mark and Lauren Wendler in San Diego. And here's Sue Lee Davis, a lieutenant colonel with the U.S. Army Medical Corps in San Antonio. She is single, no kids, and decided to completely overhaul her money habits.
I was spending in an unconscious manner before. I enjoyed buying new cars. I'd probably never drove anything older than a car that was about 4 years old. Liked to live in nicer neighborhoods and sort of the trendy and hip areas. And those typically are a little bit more expensive. So I recently returned from Afghanistan, and I don't know if it was a function of just getting accustomed to living a bit more austerely and simply, or watching the world economic crisis unfold. So I've made a conscious decision now to have an emergency fund that's fairly robust. I've kept my car. I haven't made any major appliance purchases like new TVs, although, you know, I mean, certainly that's very attractive. I go through a litmus test. Do I need this or do I want this? Actually, I don't find it was difficult at all. In fact, it was very liberating. I do feel like I have more control. I did share with some folks my plans to take vacation in San Diego this weekend, and rather than rent a car and stay in a nice hotel room downtown, I decided to stay on a military base, and I'm renting a bicycle. So they thought that was pretty silly and a little bit overly frugal, but I just think it adds to the vacation experience. It's like an insurance policy, and it's a freedom from worries of the unknown.
Suli Davis of San Antonio. So both these examples featured both large and small ways to downsize your lifestyle and gain a little more control over your financial future, even if you are not the Federal Reserve. But by downsizing, you are naturally denying yourself something, right? Well, we wondered how long it might take the typical downsizer to decide, you know what? I want a cookie and an iPad. Matt Wallert is a behavioral scientist with the firm Churnless, and he is here to help answer that question. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So we've just heard some things that folks are doing to get their spending down, really in an effort to perhaps have some control over their financial lives when there's so much that is out of our control these days. But generally, are these kinds of changes the kind that will last?
So when you hear people doing things like downsizing to a smaller home or moving to a cheaper car, those are great because they're big structural changes. Mm-hmm. You make them once and then they repeat and they're environmental and you're not constantly struggling with your own self-control and your own self-will. When you talk about things that are more behavioral, like going out to eat less or trying to make smaller discretionary purchases, those are things where you're constantly having to remake a decision and always struggling against yourself. And those are harder to upkeep.
I suppose that makes sense. I mean, those are daily struggles versus a one-time decision to move or downsize your car.
Absolutely. So environments are a key place where people can make structural changes that can have long-lasting economic effects for them.
You know, we've also wondered about this phrase that kind of keeps popping up, which is frugal fatigue. And this is, you know, the notion, yes, you can deny yourself going out to dinner for weeks and months on end. But at some point, aren't you going to break?
Yeah. So I think that's key. And again, I like the word fatigue because it reminds people of the sort of other exertions in their life. Making a decision, any decision, actually burns some energy. And there's some research that suggests that it even burns glucose in the brain. And as people make decisions, each successive decision that they make without time to rest tends to get worse and worse and worse. And you're always struggling against yourself. And so that can be literally exhausting. And that's why I like the idea of structural changes, because you make the decision once and then you're not constantly remaking the decision every day, every day, every day. And that's what gets tiring to people.
That is the advice that you sometimes hear with dieting, where if you keep denying yourself, eventually you're going to get sick of it. So go ahead and have like half a cookie.
Right. Absolutely. Or a Hershey's Kiss. You just don't have right. to have the whole bag.
So it sounds like kind of when you shut off every little piece of frivolousness, you're going to have some sort of reaction to that.
Absolutely. And I think that I'm struggling with this answer because I really want to say a thing that you're not allowed to say on radio. we have a name for this phenomenon where people have this sort of catastrophic breakdown. We sort of artificially call it, and you can beat me in a second, the f*** it all phenomenon. And so basically what happens is that people get so low and they try so hard that then there's this catastrophic failure where they just throw their hands up in the air and say, I'm going on vacation.
So how do you deal with that? Our premise here is that with all this crazy stuff going on in the world, particularly in our financial markets, that, you know, maybe one way that you can take control is by downsizing, by reducing your spending, by making yourself feel better about your financial position. What's the best way to do that effectively then?
The best place to start with your financial situation is to make sure you actually know what it is. Have you sat down and done a budget? Have you actually looked at where your money is going? You know, we sometimes talk about things in three buckets. There's the needs, the wants, and the nice to haves. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes I recommend that people actually sit down, look at where their money is going, and make sure that you have all of your needs, some of your wants, and a few of the nice to haves. And you want to make sure that that's happening, because if you're just doing the need bucket, that's not sustainable over the long term. No one wants to live that lifestyle, and eventually you're not going to be able to sustain your motivation. It's a little like running a marathon. You don't start the first day and try and run 20 miles. You work yourself up to a place where you're ready.
But what if you're really, really impatient like me? I want to run my marathon tomorrow.
And how many marathons have you run?
None.
Exactly. Right? Impatience is your enemy here. I think that's the real problem, is that any kind of long, permanent, lasting change that you're making in your life requires some patience.
All right. Matt Wallert is a behavioral scientist and lead scientist for the firm Churnless. Thanks so much for coming in. It's been fun.
Thank you, Tess.
And we've got more tips on downsizing your lifestyle in tough times on our Making Money blog at marketplace.org. And before we leave this notion of dealing with macroeconomic uncertainty by fixing your own microeconomics, let's hear from commentator J.D. Roth. He is not concerning himself with the markets or the media coverage. He's paying attention to something else.
Everywhere I go, I hear news of financial doom and gloom. The stock market is crashing. The dollar is inflating. Oil is peaking and homes are foreclosing. It's like it's 2008 all over again. Well, maybe it is and maybe it isn't. I don't know. What I do know is that I've learned some lessons from past meltdowns. The national economy may be sinking, but my personal economy is ready to weather the storm. What do I mean by that? First, I have no debt. I carried consumer debt for nearly 20 years, and every time the economy sputtered, I worried what might happen if I couldn't make my monthly payments. Being debt-free lets me sleep well at night. But it's more than that. I now have emergency savings, and I keep my expenses well below my income. Meanwhile, my investments match my risk tolerance. A big chunk of my retirement is in bonds because the ups and downs of the stock market make me nervous. So now I'm able to ignore the bleak economic news and live my life as normal. I'm not sharing this to brag. Yes, it's important to pay attention to the financial news, but my goal is to show that while the national economy does affect us, how we handle our personal finances is far more important. Many of my friends have learned this too. After losing jobs during the last downturn or selling stocks in a panic when the market dropped, today the people I talk to are much more stoic or pragmatic or smart. They too have paid off debt, built savings, and developed investment plans. This is my mantra. Nobody cares more about your money than you do. When times are flush, you need to prepare for an uncertain future. Then, when the next crisis comes around, you can remain calm while the stock market tumbles and unemployment rises and inflation rears its ugly head. We can't change the national economy, but we can control our household finances. Ultimately, each of us is responsible for the health and growth of our own personal economy.
J.D. Roth is the founder of GetRichSlowly.org. Send us your comments. Go to marketplace.org or leave them on our Facebook page. This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and it is time for your questions. Helping us out this week is Kathy Kristoff, personal finance columnist for Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine. Hi, Kathy.
Hey, Tess. How's it going?
You're looking quite rested. vacation, perhaps?
Yes. Return? Just got back from vacation, and I want to go back to vacation.
You and me both.
I should be rested, but you know how you get to that point where you're actually a little too rested?
Yes.
You know? And you're like reading your email and thinking, do I really care? You know? I'm just not sure right now whether I want to watch the market.
You know? Right. Exactly. So did you go anywhere fun?
Yeah, I went to Italy.
Oh.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome.
But you didn't bring me with you.
I'm sorry. Yeah, next trip.
Okay, thank you so much. Well, in the meantime, earlier in the show, we heard from some folks who were doing some pretty drastic things in order to give themselves some sense of financial control in the craziness that's going on right now. But you added this recent column where you suggested something kind of unusual for people who are getting close to retirement. You said that they should
take more vacations.
Yeah, what?
Yeah. T. Rowe Price did a great study on this and found that one of the reasons why people are so anxious to retire is because they work so hard leading up to retirement so that they can save every dime.
Yeah.
And they analyzed it and found that there's no way you can save enough to have a significant impact in those last 5 or 10 years toward retirement.
It's too late.
It's your money is not going to multiply that
right.
fast, whatever. And if instead you work less, vacation more, and just work an extra year or two, that difference is going to have far more impact on your retirement readiness than saving like crazy and,
right.
you know.
And not enjoying your life.
Exactly.
All right. Excellent advice. So let's turn to the phones and see how folks are doing with their money and perhaps even their vacation plans. Christina is with us from Hamilton, New Jersey. Hi there.
Hi.
How are you doing today?
Good, good. How are you?
Very well, very well. So we've been hearing all about Kathy's trip to Italy. Have you done any traveling this summer yourself?
Not yet, but my family is going on vacation this week. Nowhere as glamorous as Italy, but we are staying at a lake house in upstate New York.
Oh,
and
nice.
I'm told that neither my cell phone nor my internet connection will work all that well. So I'm kind of looking forward to dropping off the grid for a little bit.
Well, good for you, Christina. That sounds fantastic. Plus, you'll be getting away from Irene.
That's the plan.
Well, how are you feeling about your finances these days?
We're trying to get our cards in order with our finances, and we know what we should be doing, but...
So we're hearing a we. Is this you and your husband?
Yes.
And how have we been approaching this these days?
Well, our problem, I think, is that we have a lot of goals. Building an emergency fund, we should be saving for retirement, mm-hmm. we should be saving for the kids for college. But if you were to hand us a check for $1,000, we wouldn't know what to do with it. Like, what are we supposed to do first?
Well, I think, Kathy, this is a fairly common problem that everybody faces. You know, it's where do I put whatever money I can set aside?
Right.
There have to be these priorities, and it's very confusing to try to figure out what that should be.
Yeah. Well, you know what? It's always an order of operations question. You have to look at what the risks are in your life. And then start looking at where should I really allocate resources, right? And so you look at it and say, okay, so how secure is my job? How secure is my husband's job? How many risks do we have on an emergency fund? If you look at your car's a junker, your jobs are a little insecure, you have a lot of risks, then you say, absolutely, that emergency fund is number one priority.
Yeah.
And I would say normally, if you don't have any emergency fund, that's where you start. After that, do you have a 401k plan?
We do.
Great.
But I have a question about that as well.
Okay.
He got a raise recently, and we thought, oh, well, when you get a raise, you're supposed to put it in your 401k.
Right.
And then you'll never miss it.
Right.
My question is, should I put his raise in his 401k or mine because he's 7 years older than I am. And in theory, he'll retire first. Do I put it with him because he needs the money sooner or with me because it'll have more time to grow?
You know what? Split it. Why don't you both up your contribution rates?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, whether you have more time or whether you don't have more time, whether you retire earlier, it doesn't matter because really this is all one big pot of money, right? You're happily married. You're not thinking, oh, as soon as I retire, I'm going to leave him.
No, the idea is that we're going to retire together.
There you go.
So there you go. So it doesn't make any difference at all.
So that kind of answers the retirement fund question, but have we gotten to this notion of what your goals are? I mean, that really seems to be what you were stuck on in the first place, trying to figure out what your priorities were. Is that something that you guys have talked about together?
Well, we try to talk about it, and the conversation usually goes pretty well, and then a small child dressed as a superhero will run in and tell us we have to go save the city, and that's, like, way more important than an emergency fund. So off we go, and then the conversation never gets picked up.
But you saved the city.
But I saved the city, and really, I feel like at the end of the day, that's the more important thing.
Absolutely.
You are so right. And you know what? Here's the thing I would tell you. Fund your emergency account. Because it's good to feel secure. Put as much money as you can into those 401k plans. You don't have to worry that much. You're on completely the right track. You're saving money. You know that you have all these different goals. You're funding them.
And you are talking about them, even though that talk is interrupted every once in a while.
Yeah.
Does that help you out?
It's very helpful.
Good. Thanks so much for the call, Christina.
Thanks.
All right, next up we have Joy, and she is in Rochester, Minnesota. Hi, Joy.
Hi, Tess.
What a fun name.
Thank you.
So what do you do there?
So I'm a dietitian.
Oh, let me guess. You're at the Mayo Clinic.
Hi, that is correct.
Yeah.
The Mayo Clinic. We do a lot of helping people just eat in general. I work in the area of transplants, so a lot of times we're working on just getting people to eat anything.
Yeah.
So we're the dietitian they like to see when we say, would you take a milkshake if I got you a milkshake?
You're offering milkshakes? <So.
laughs>
That's not broccoli and brown rice.
No.
Wow.
There's plenty of that too, but sometimes they just need to eat. Tess, I was gonna say that, you know, following up on your story a few weeks ago about donating body parts and fluids to make
right.
money, that, you know, being an organ, tissue, blood donor will pay you back in ways you'll never be able to monetize necessarily. I always encourage everybody to become an organ, tissue donor.
I totally agree. I've got that little dot on my driver's license.
Talk to your family about being a
donor. I have. I absolutely have. We've had long conversations. It's also in my living trust and will that is what I want to do.
Good for you.
Yep.
Good for you.
Public service announcement.
That's
right. So how can we help you out today then?
So my question is actually about the cash accumulation fund that's associated with universal life insurance. I've been with my current employer, Mayo, for 3 years. When I first signed up during orientation for benefits, the universal life insurance cash accumulation fund was sort of presented to me like a savings account. And I thought, well, I'm not so great at savings when I can see it in my bank account. So this, I thought, well, I'll put $5 in there every pay period. I didn't honestly think about it all until a news item came across our intranet website saying, if you participate in the cash accumulation fund, the interest rate will remain the same through the end of April 2012. And the interest rate is 4%. So, of course, my eyes popped out of my head.
Yeah, nobody's getting that these days.
I checked into my account and wow, it's already grown to over $500. And I just want to know, should I be putting more into there? I don't understand exactly. Is it like savings?
Okay, Kathy, this is sounding perhaps like an annuity. That would be my guess. What is a cash accumulation fund?
Well, it's a universal life insurance policy, and it has restrictions on taking money out just like a 401k plan, mm-hmm. But different. Usually what you can do is borrow money out of the policy, not necessarily withdraw money from the policy. So no, it is not a good emergency fund. If you borrow money out of the policy, you have to pay it back with interest. If you don't pay it back with interest, it's a withdrawal, and then you're subject to penalties and, you know, taxes. The downside also to a universal life policy is that while you're getting a good rate of interest right now, there is no guarantee that you're going to get that good rate of interest after 2012. So, yeah.
But Kathy, what about this as a savings vehicle that you're not counting on taking it out like you would for an emergency fund? I mean, is this still a decent place to put her money if she's getting 4%?
A long-term savings vehicle, you can use a universal policy that way. I don't like to because you are locked in for long-term. Mm-hmm. Your interest rate is not. And I don't like that. I would limit the amount of money that I kept in that policy.
So would you say just keep that amount in there because you don't want to be taking it out for the reasons we already explained?
Right.
But perhaps that extra $5 a month should be going toward your 401k or somewhere else instead.
Yeah, I wouldn't do much with a universal life policy. I don't think they're great deals.
Good to know.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Okay.
All right.
Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, let's go next to Matt, and he is in, Williamsburg, Virginia. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Tess. Great to be with you.
Oh, we're glad to have you on. Everything calmed down there a little bit?
Well, we've stopped shaking for the moment. I was at school. I was in the business school building, and the whole building shook. So we all evacuated, but tried to get back to our routine.
Well, I'm glad everything turned out okay for you there, Matt. So you say that you're in class?
That's right. Recently returned to school as a full-time grad student. I taught high school math for 5 years.
So what are you hoping to do with that once you graduate?
I'll go into public accounting.
All right. Well, so if you've been teaching high school math and you're studying in a business school, why do you need us to help you out today?
Yeah, I'm feeling a little inadequate.
Well, I'd like to claim that my finances are as pristine shape as my resume suggests they should be. I'm calling because I got to hear a program a couple weeks ago when a call came in who was asking about the viability of private student loans. I didn't hear everything that Kathy had to say, but I heard her say that, in general, private student loans should be avoided.
Yep.
You know, I have a private student loan, and I was wondering if there are cases where they are more acceptable.
Good question. Good follow-up question. First of all, how much did you borrow?
About $11,000 to get me through one semester.
Okay. Well, Kathy, review for us briefly the downside of a private student loan. We did address this before, but just give us a little rundown.
Well, I mean, the big thing is private student loans are generally variable rate. And so even though the rate may seem not that bad right now, we're at historically low interest rates. And so when interest rates rise, the rate on that private student loan could rise a lot. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that federal student loans have all sorts of protections on repayment. Private student loans are not like that. So if you can't afford to pay right now, they'll say, okay, give us $250 and we'll, you know, give you six more months. We will accrue interest at whatever the going rate is on that loan, and but we'll give you six more months to pay it. And that's not the kind of deal you get with the federal government.
So essentially, a private student loan is just a loan. I mean, it's like pretty much any other loan that you're going to take out.
It's essentially like a credit card loan.
Right. All right. So does that help you out, Matt?
I really appreciate it. Thanks for going over this with me again, Kat.
It's our pleasure. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you for having me.
If you've got a question, give us a call. Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or you can always send us an email at the Getting Personal link on our website. It is marketplace.org. Kathy Kristoff, thanks again for coming in and welcome back from vacation.
Thanks very much, Tess.
And do remember to always check with your own financial professional before you make any big money decisions. Matt's question about paying for school is certainly one that lots of parents and students are grappling with right now. But beyond the tuition payment, many newly minted college freshmen are about to start dealing with their own finances for the first time. They will have to budget. They'll have to learn that credit cards do not get paid off by a magical fairy. So for some tips on getting your college-bound kid ready for financial freedom, at least to some extent, we're joined by our good friend and financial journalist Carmen Wong Ulrich. Glad to have you back.
Thanks, Tess. Thanks for having me.
I know some folks who actually will set up an account for their college student and put, for example, even the tuition money in there, room and board money in there, so that the check actually comes from the kid and they can see what this education is costing, and that's another way to kind of make them aware of money itself.
Sure. I mean, any kind of system you can set up where the student feels responsible for what's going on. Because here's the thing, I think we're past the point where college is just seen as a rite of passage that we just all kind of go through to move ahead in life. It really needs to be seen now, because it's so expensive, as an investment. And it's in the student's best interest to really realize what sacrifice and expense a parent goes through to make this investment happen. And pay off, of course. And I really believe that it's important you have these discussions before they go to school, and also set up a system that they can start building credit before they graduate. So what you can do is you can co-sign on a card or open a card jointly with a very, very low balance, so they can't go crazy and ruin your credit, that they can utilize while they're in school and while they're paying their student loans. And student loans is another big thing. Really talking to them about how a student loan works and the real cost of it is very, very important as well.
Let's talk about some of the common money issues that particularly freshmen are going to encounter as, you know, they may be starting to manage their own money for the very first time.
Well, some of the biggest mistakes are having no budget at all.
Yeah.
And by budget, I mean saying that you put $500 or $1,000 onto a debit card account or into their account, and that's supposed to last them a certain period of time, and they just see the money in there and just keep using it and not realizing how quickly it's going or keeping track in any way. It's really good to sit down, you know, with your student and kind of say, okay, let's estimate how much, you know, going out to eat is going to cost you, or how much you're going to be driving, what your books are going to be, and lay that out first and say, okay, here's the amount of money we have, and not just give a flat amount. Because you'd be surprised how much pizza can cost.
You've mentioned a couple of times prepaid credit cards, secure credit cards. Are those good options for students? Perhaps the best way to make sure that they don't get themselves in trouble?
Not so much the prepaid. I think the secured card is a very specific kind of card. So this card, basically, you put money aside or you deposit it onto the card. And then they extend you a line of credit. As you use the card responsibly, they'll extend you more credit. But it doesn't work like a debit card. It actually works like a credit card with a deposit that's put on there, kind of like your first and last month's deposit on a house or on an apartment. Secured cards can bill credit as well. You want to make sure that they report to the credit reporting agencies before you get one. But if your credit is bad or you're worried that they're not going to be responsible, then maybe you don't want to co-sign on a credit card.
Any other personal finance tips for particularly those incoming freshmen who will be facing life on their own, perhaps for the first time?
Well, I'll tell you this. Be nice to your parents.
I'll
tell you why. Because I also hear from parents who are doing things which are not advisable, such as mortgaging their homes, taking money out of their retirement. We all had these dreams, and I know I did. If I got to go to this school, I've got to get this degree, I've got to, you know, and it's very expensive. If they can't afford to do it without jeopardizing their retirement, find another way and be a part of that process with them. We shouldn't feel entitled to that degree. They can help us, but to a point. In the end, we don't want to have to take care of our parents, which many of us end up doing. So the more you can help out with paying for school, the less you'll have to help them out down the road. And you have a lot more time to earn money and pay off that debt.
Carmen Wong Ulrich is a personal finance journalist and author of The Real Cost of Living. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. 10 years ago, author Barbara Ehrenreich released a book called Nickel and Dimed on Not Getting By in America. It was a stunning portrayal of this country's working class, seen through her own eyes as she went undercover in minimum wage jobs to document what it was like to live on those wages. A 10th anniversary edition is now on bookshelves, and Barbara Ehrenreich joins us to talk about that decade. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be with you.
Let's remind audiences that when this book came out, it was the height of the dot-com bubble. It was before 9/11, a very troubled decade economically since then. Talk to me a little bit about where this book fit into the zeitgeist at that point in time.
Well, at that point in time, there was a lot of sense that we had kind of conquered the business cycle, that we could only go up, up, and up. So I think what was surprising to many people about the book is that here was a report on people who represent about a third of the American population who are low-paid workers and who are not doing well in the best of times. You know, things that really shocked me were like finding out that I was sometimes working alongside full-time workers who were homeless, you know, who slept in their pickup trucks or slept in their vans. People who didn't get enough to eat. All this, you know, while it was supposed to be peak prosperity.
So here we are 10 years later in a very different environment. Where do you think it would fit now if you published?
Well, I don't know if I could do the same things that I did, like going out and getting entry-level jobs, because that's what I did. I would see a now hiring sign and I'd present myself and fill out the application form and have a job. I mean, I could really walk off the street. There aren't those signs anymore. So it would not be possible to do the same thing today.
When you look around now at working families similar to the ones that you basically hung out with for a good period of time, what do you see? Is there a difference?
Today?
Mm-hmm.
I think things are harder. Very striking that food and fuel costs have gone up so much. Fewer people have any access to medical care. Not that a lot of my coworkers did 10 years ago, but now it's one of the first things that people have to give up. You can't hold on to that health insurance if it's, say, $1,000, $2,000 a month. So I see much more hardship today.
You say in the afterword, that's been updated for the 10th anniversary, that for a couple of years you've been trying to gauge the plight of the working poor through some more traditional methods. You're not doing the jobs again, but you are talking with people. What, if any, differences are you finding in either the experience or who you end up talking to?
Well, now, you know, you're likely to encounter, entering the ranks of the poor, more people who started out middle class, who may have higher degrees, may have a master's degree, and then were laid off. And they become a big part of the long-term unemployed. Because once you're over, say, 45 or 50, nobody's going to want to hire you. There's also, this is something I think that is more recent, employers do not want to hire unemployed people.
Yeah, they've come out and said that.
Right, and we've seen that they, in growing numbers, I think it's about 70% of employers now, check your credit rating before hiring you. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to have a good credit rating if you've been out of work for 6 months. So we're creating a big category of people who are long-term unemployed, and they're really no longer part of the larger economy.
One criticism that you level at those of us in the media is our focus on what you call the nouveau poor, which I think you've kind of just touched on now. The folks who were doing just fine before the financial collapse, but who are now leading very different lives. Where do you think the focus should be?
Well, I think it has to encompass both the nouveau poor and the chronically poor. There were for decades many prejudices about the chronically poor. They are lazy. They are promiscuous. They are addicted. That's why they're poor.
And that's one criticism that was leveled at you with the book, right? That you were profiling, people who should be bootstrapping themselves.
Yeah, that I was perhaps not revealing all the terrible self-destructive habits that had caused these people to be poor. Mm-hmm. And whoever raises that question isn't really facing up to the question as, well, who is going to take care of grandma in a nursing home? But I think one of the things that the existence of the nouveau poor should do is undercut all those prejudices once and for all. It's not a matter of something wrong with you individually if you fall into poverty.
When you published this book 10 years ago, I don't know if you remember what was in your head at the time in terms of your expectations for, 10 years down the line. What did you think a decade later would look like?
I was quite hopeful. Around the time the book came out, there was a growing movement for a, quote, living wage, that if you work, you should earn enough to live on at some kind of minimal level. So that spirit was growing up until the, what should I call it now, the first financial crash, the crash in 07 and 08.
The financial crisis.
Yeah. I don't know. Do we have to start numbering them now? I don't know. There was that sense. And then once the recession began, that whole conversation shut down. The line became, you're lucky to have any job, so just shut up and do it.
Not where we expected to be.
Not where I expected to be, no.
Barbara Ehrenreich, thank you for coming in.
My pleasure.
Barbara Ehrenreich is the author most recently of Bright Sided, How Positive Thinking is Undermining America. We've been talking with her about the 10th anniversary reissue of her seminal tale of the working poor, Nickel and Dimed. You can find more at our book blog, The Big Book, at marketplace.org. You might say you'd need the luck of the Irish to find a job in this economy, but the Irish would tell you their luck isn't worth what it was a decade ago. The Celtic Tiger roared for several years in the late 90s and early 2000s. And then, with the global economic crisis, it turned into a listless kitty cat. The Irish government stepped in to rescue banks. The European Union bailed out the government. But along the way, citizens learned a thing or two about finance. Christopher Worth has our story from Dublin.
Ireland, like the U.S., has had a tough few years. Plummeting property prices, a national credit downgrade, and deep worries over debt. And just like Americans, the Irish have had to learn a new vocabulary of troublesome economic terms, like credit default swaps.
And subordinated debt.
Collateralized debt obligations.
Debt values and bond prices.
Jill Kirby is a personal finance columnist in Ireland for the Sunday Times newspaper. She says during the boom years of the Celtic Tiger, no one paid attention to this stuff.
They were just having a good time spending all this debt that the banks were throwing at them.
That is, until 2008, when all of that debt plunged Ireland into one of the worst banking crises in Europe. Since then, it's plowed over $100 billion into bailing out its banks, a huge sum for a country of just 4.5 million people. Ben Tanra is a political scientist at University College Dublin, or UCD. He says one good thing that's come out of it is that because those 4.5 million people are left paying the bill, everyone has essentially given themselves a crash course in finance and economics.
It's quite an extraordinary transformation. We know all about debt yields. We talk in terms of basis points instead of interest rates. We're probably the best educated state in terms of knowing how banking systems now work. It's just a shame maybe we didn't have that knowledge a little bit earlier.
But as the saying goes, better late than never. And just maybe, that means Ireland will be less likely to make the same mistakes twice, says Liam Delaney. He's a researcher at UCD's Geary Institute, which studies the impact of public policy on people's daily lives.
When you get a taxi back to the airport, you know, talk to anybody about what the banking system should be like, and they'll be able to give you a view. And I think that's a positive sign.
So I decided to take Delaney's challenge to find out just how many amateur economists there are on this little island. And to do that, I enlisted the help of an actual economist.
Introducing myself now.
Brian Lucey is a professor of finance at Trinity College Dublin. And he joined me on a very unscientific experiment to ask the city's taxi drivers what they would do to fix Ireland's broken banking system.
And with a bit of luck, we'll find a taxi man who's not short of an opinion.
So we step out on the curb.
Taxi!
And cabbie Thomas O'Byrne stops to pick us up.
Hello, I'm a journalist with American Public Radio.
And our question, should senior bondholders or senior investors in Ireland's failed banks be paid back in full? It sounds technical, but it's a big debate in Ireland because as it stands, Irish taxpayers are on the hook for billions of dollars. So what would O'Byrne do differently?
I don't know if anything can be done differently. I mean, we can't completely burn bondholders. I think just the great tragedy is that we arrived at this position.
When you say burn the bondholders, what do you mean?
What I mean by that is they took the risk. If their investment fails, they lose their investment.
In other words, the private sector would be forced to take on at least some of the burden of dealing with Ireland's ballooning debt. It's not a sentiment shared by the European Central Bank or our next economically savvy taxi driver, Breida Doyle.
We know we can't do that because, well, forevermore, amen, nobody would ever give us a penny again, would they?
Not to say she's happy about that. In fact, Doyle says the more she learns about Ireland's financial troubles, the angrier she becomes.
More knowledge makes you more angry. And little did I ever think I would even be talking about finances. You know, I mean, I didn't want to know about bailouts and the IMF or anything else, but did we ever want to know all this? We didn't, but we do.
So do you feel the better off for that?
No.
Ignorance was bliss.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Yeah. I thought we were very happy people.
And sadly, she doesn't think knowing more will necessarily keep anyone from making the same mistakes all over again. In Dublin, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace Money.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Hands in my pocket, hands in my pocket, hands in my pockets.
Because of your giant wallet, just get rid of it.
Never. It is a part of me.
My name is Erica Iorio. We're in Brooklyn Heights, and I just cleaned out my wallet, but there's still some stuff in here. Like an expired New York State ID. I don't have a driver's license. What about a current one? Well, that would require a trip to the DMV. Oh, this is a I have a Staples receipt. I was planning a fake summer camp. I'd never been to summer camp, so like it's basically just a party we throw. And we have arts and crafts, and we have a talent show, and we have like a camp dance and stuff like that. And this was all, if you look at the list, it's four containers of glitter hearts. Oh, name tags. Neon green folders, so I could keep track of the camp budget. And it's just a huge party. But we're up at 10 a.m. for activities, for kayaking or crafts or whatever we have to do.
I really don't want to remind anyone of this, least of all myself, but next weekend is Labor Day weekend, the official end of summer. I'm sorry. For kids, it's back to school, back to work. But plenty of them spent the summer working, some of it on the sidewalk just outside their houses. And it turns out the tough economy can hand you a lesson just about anywhere these days. Michigan Radio's Jennifer Guerra has more.
Molly and Lucy Prochaska have been in the lemonade business in Ann Arbor, Michigan for the past 5 years.
We sell lemonade, iced tea, Arnold Palmer's, and popsicles.
Their price points are pretty fair for the area. 10-year-old Lucy says the popsicles go for 50 cents, and the drinks come in different sizes.
The large cup is $1, and the small cup is 50 cents.
They're serious about their lemonade business. They've got a cash register, lots of signage. Lucy's older sister Molly, who's 12, even came up with a slogan for the stand.
Our lemonade has swagger.
Which they wrote in chalk up and down the sidewalks around their block. No trademark yet, but I would not underestimate these girls. Despite their guerrilla marketing tactics, Molly says business just isn't what it used to be.
The first year was really nice. We got lots of money, but then after that, when the economy started to go down, we didn't get as much money.
You think it has to do with the economy?
Probably. I mean, people didn't want to spend as much. They wanted to save their money.
Thinking that might have soured her, no pun intended, on the whole entrepreneur thing, I asked Molly if she had any ideas about what she wants to do when she grows up.
I'm not really sure yet, but the whole business thing is pretty fun, though. So.
Really?
Yeah. I like it.
I've noticed more kids are interested in being entrepreneurs now than when I started 9 years ago.
That's Ellen Daniel. She teaches language arts at a middle school in Ann Arbor, where about half the kids qualify for free or reduced lunch. She says many students at the school have parents who have been laid off because of the economy or have had to pick up and move out of town for a job, which she thinks has made an impression on the kids.
That whole idea that we've moved from an economy where you could be part of a big company and work there your whole career and retire from there, and I don't think kids see that the same way.
Sal Barrientos teaches at the same school as Ellen Daniel. He says he hears kids talk in the hallway all the time, and often, whether they realize it or not, the tough economy is part of the conversation.
A recession, where some kids are like, well, what does that even mean? Some kids will say, you know what it means? It means I can't go to the movies this weekend. It means we can't order pizza every Friday night like we want to.
Back at Molly and Lucy Prochaska's lemonade stand, it's not all doom and gloom. Despite all the economic turmoil, business was up. Molly says that could mean one of two things. Stock market be darned, the economy is on the mend.
Either that or it's super hot out, so lots of people are coming. Yeah.
In Ann Arbor, Michigan, I'm Jennifer Guerra for Marketplace Money.
But wait, before we leave the lemonade stand for good, let's get to this week's Marketplace Money Piggy Award. Our little blue plastic friend is heading to where else? Ann Arbor. Because when your lemonade business has that kind of swagger, you need an appropriate container for your cash. So, Molly, Lucy, you each have a piggy coming to you. I suggest you start saving up for the MBAs you will no doubt be pursuing. And just a reminder to the rest of you who covet our blue plastic friend, there is a random number up on the chalkboard wall in my office. When we hit that number of likes on the Marketplace Money Facebook page, that person gets a pig. You know you want one. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. As I just mentioned, you can friend us and me too on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Next time.
This is your cubicle. This is your phone. There are no personal phone calls allowed. We do, however, allow for emergencies.
Writer Daniel Orozco takes on workplace stereotypes in his collection of short stories perfectly titled Orientation. Marketplace Money is produced by John Buckley with Devin Robbins and Stephen Hoffman. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of this program is Deborah Clark. Yeah, you heard me right. She got a big promotion. Congrats, Deb. I'm Tess Vigeland. Enjoy these final days of summer, and we will see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM, American Public Media.